Timory Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember. Even with a busy speaking and radio schedule, she finds time to devote to her creative love of dance. Don Johnson is an author, speaker, and major motion picture film producer. Both hold master's degrees in theology, and together they cover the week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. From the Southern California studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending with Don and Timory.
Sometimes on the show, we get requests, and sometimes they're just demands, that we cover certain stories in the news or things that people have seen on the internet. Timmer, you have one for us.
My mom sent this over to me. She's like, you need to cover this for a segment. So I was reading through. She has a friend who posted on Facebook this story about having your cake, enjoying it, and eating it. And it was a sweet kind of moment. A man who recently just met his first grandchild and after 25 years of marriage is reflecting back on that moment of the cake at the wedding. Now, Don, I just realized why you eloped. Before the show, I was telling you this story, and your response was he should have just smashed it.
It's a beautiful story. Let's give some context here. It's this beautiful story about the guy. I think he wanted to smash the cake in her face, right?
And it must have been talked about ahead of time.
Yeah, and so they were planning this, and she said, no. The cake has a lot of symbolism. In fact, what were some of the things that the cake represented?
Trust. It represented nurturing. It represented that she can trust him to provide for her and care for her. And it'll be one of those moments where she's vulnerable and really setting her beautiful face in wedding dress in his arms. And it's a symbol for her of their whole marriage.
I give myself to you in your hands. You feed me, provide for me. It is a beautiful thing. And so he's submitted. He said, yeah, you're right. That makes a lot of sense. I would be glad to feed the cake to you and not smash it in your face. Now, as I was listening to it, I'll admit, Timmy, I was really hoping that the end of it would have been her taking the cake and just smashing it in his face. I thought that this would have been ideal. That would have been made it a great story. No, it was just a nice, sweet story. And it was. But it would have been a lot funnier if she had smashed.
It is a neat story of implementing a trust into your relationship. And I think at the end of the day, guys, never take the cake and smash it in her face. Like, in what way does that make sense? Truly, it may be hilarious, but do it in a practice round. How about that?
Yeah, what is the point of it? It's just another one of those things. You know, last show we talked about the toilet papering of the houses. It's one of those things I just don't get. I haven't quite ever understood the whole cake smashing thing. Is it? What is the deal? You get all fancy
smashing.
And then you smash the cake.
It's funny, isn't
it? Is it? I don't know. I guess. Maybe, Timory, I just have no sense of humor.
I don't find it funny. I feel bad for those poor women. I've seen wedding videos from family members who have had the cake smashed in their face and it has not ended well.
Well, it is sort of taking advantage of the other person for someone else's humor, like we've set up the video. I mean, I'm not opposed to practical jokes necessarily, but sometimes they just don't seem like, and then maybe this is another one of those situations.
And I think that it is a beautiful moment of what, for some reason, I don't get why the cake was part of the wedding to begin with, but I think that she has a very neat take on it, that if you're going to do this, since people have just turned it into a joke, let's kind of draw from, I actually am trusting you not to be a buffoon and smash a cake in my face.
Yeah, it makes sense. You know, you're right. We didn't have the big fancy wedding, my wife and I, and we weren't Catholics at the time, so there wasn't any sort of really fanciness at all. We went to Lake Tahoe to a hotel with a few of our friends. But what I did at the wedding was foot washing. I actually washed her feet, which was my sort of symbolism of feet. I don't remember the cake. I believe we went across the street to Chevy's and had burritos, if I remember correctly.
Sounds like you have some good memories.
And got the big sombreros. I shouldn't be telling people all these things. Like, what kind of life has Dawn lived? What is going on with the guy?
You're celebrating 20 years of
marriage. 20
years,
that's right. We're still okay.
But
it worked out all right.
It shows the awesome story of development in each of our lives, where we are, where we go. And at the heart of it, you're two people in love who pursued marriage, and today that's something that people don't often pursue anymore.
Well, and you know, we were young and in love and the whole thing. Well, I mean, one of the reasons we weren't Catholic, but one of the reasons we pursued marriage was well, we don't want to live in sin. Right? It wasn't like today where we've talked about, well, we're going to have sex before we date sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
No, we want to be together. So what do you do when you get married? Right? That was the whole mindset. And I don't know. I don't think that was a very popular mindset then. It certainly isn't now. The rate of people not getting married is terrible. But you know what? They don't get married. And then when they do, or if they do, it doesn't last. So there is something to be said for tying the knot. All right, what do we have on our trending list this week?
You know, this week came out a really good, I think, informational piece from Live Action. Live Action, as we know, my dear friend Lila Rose, who works and has done a number of undercover sting operations exposing the work taking place behind closed doors in Planned Parenthood. And I am telling you, even if it's one of the investigations from 5 years ago, you need to know what happens behind these closed doors. From statutory rape cases, you have examples of unreported minor sexual abuse, raping, and just horrible advice being given to young teenagers about truly masochistic sexual encounters, as long as it's all compliant on both ends. But this time, not quite as heavy as some of the others. They're just providing an informational piece. And here's what came out. As people are talking about Planned Parenthood needing to be defunded, here's from the perspective of women's health care, Don.
Right.
We are seeing hundreds of millions of dollars going into Planned Parenthood to fund women's health care. Well, over the last 10 years or so, even a little bit longer, they've seen half a million fewer clients than they did before. Not only that, there's been a huge decrease in some of their services. 77% decrease in pap tests, a 68% decrease in cancer screenings, and a 60% decrease in breast exams. This is basic fundamental health care for women, especially women who are sexually active today.
Yeah, this is the big smokescreen, right? They keep saying, oh, we do all these women's health things. They don't actually, I mean, I don't think you can actually walk into most Planned Parenthoods and get breast exam or whatever, right? You're not going to find them there.
It's very rare that they provide them. And you can look it up by just calling your local Planned Parenthood and asking.
Absolutely. They're going to say, no, we don't do that. Then there's good videos on that out there. So the decrease in number is of decrease of women showing up for those other services.
Yes.
I don't know what the numbers are.
Well,
for abortions, though.
That's the thing. They've seen a 30% increase almost in abortions. So here's the thing, you guys. This is what you need to understand. For all of your pro-women friends, and I'll tell you, I've even done work for some of the dioceses here in Southern California, helping to write think pieces for the public newspapers. And I've even received pushback among the staff high up in different levels of the church saying, well, Planned Parenthood does great things and they provide great services for women who are marginalized. And I say, no, they don't. They provide contraception, condoms, and just in case you need it, abortion.
And the order is abortion first.
Abortion first.
Right.
30% increase. You guys, you are being pro-woman to even your pro-abortion friends when you say Planned Parenthood should be defunded because they're encouraging sexual activity, but then they're not providing the basic care that a lot of these women need with basic pap tests, cancer screenings, and breast exams that are truly consequences of the group one carcinogen lifestyle of hormonal contraception and abortion.
Absolutely. And those things that they do provide, those maybe somewhere. We don't know where. Those are all available somewhere else. It's not like they need government money to keep those things going.
Exactly. And that's a problem. So as Planned Parenthood sees a decrease in their clientele, they see an increase in abortion services. What business is Planned Parenthood in? They're in the abortion business.
Well, and this is the thing. It's not that women have chosen to stop going. Planned Parenthood has made conscious decisions to go where the money is. The money's in abortions. You look at anyone who has come out of Planned Parenthood, and there's more and more, thankfully.
Yes.
They'll tell you it is a money-making machine. We have a quota for how many abortions we want to do. We want to push people to have abortions because that's where the money is. And then they sell the baby parts, you know? It's like it's a crazy money-making machine that absolutely does not need any government money and should not have any. And this is a no-brainer on so many levels.
And it's a am just listening to the information we've just given out in the last 5 minutes about Planned Parenthood, Dawn. And to be honest, for the listener, anyone hearing right now, this is a tidal wave of information of awful things Planned Parenthood is doing, both on an intentional level with some of the selling of fetal remains, just a manipulation of their clients, but also now how they're running money and the types of clients they're seeking to serve. You guys, make sure you're educated in this so that you feel equipped on this topic. I had just this week, Dawn, I'm writing a piece. It'll come out over the next couple weeks for Endow Voices. Endow is an awesome ministry providing education for women. Really looking at St. John Paul II's work, Edith Stein. And so I wrote a piece for them having to do with how do I respond and live amongst my pro-women, pro-feminist friends and kind of respond. I'm pro-woman too, but right. I'm pro-life. And so look out for that. But here are great, I think, pieces of information for you to defend your position in a level-headed way.
Absolutely. I heard a different talk radio station, and they were talking about where government money is going. And of course, there's a big fight this week, and we pre-record the show and it airs several times. So this may have developed, but there's a big fight this week over, well, are we going to fund the wall? Or Planned Parenthood funding, I think, is getting mixed up in some of this. And there's going to be a choice. Well, is the money going to go for the wall? Well, if it does, then we're going to keep it going to Planned Parenthood, this kind of thing. And one of the other hosts says, I do not care at all about Planned Parenthood. I just want that wall. And I think this is so backwards. The fact that tax money is going to this organization is a great evil. It has to stop.
And the fact that people wouldn't care.
And they wouldn't care is devastating. All right, you're listening to Trending with Dawn and Timory. We'll be right back.
From the studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending. Trending with Dawn and Timory, applying timeless principles to today's hottest topics.
Dawn, there's this outbreak of controversy taking place in New York in the Manhattan Financial District. Here's the deal. What was a sign of a guerrilla art about 30 years ago or so now, right after the 1987 global stock market crash, there was a Sicilian immigrant, actually, Arturo Di Modica, who created this huge charging bull. And it was meant to be a symbol of the strength and power of the American people in a time of struggle. And what happened is he actually commissioned to have this made with his own personal money and then just dumped it here in the Manhattan Financial District.
It's quite iconic. I think if anyone has ever seen pictures of New York, it's a very familiar sign, this big bronze bull. And I did not know the backstory. I thought that was something New York had put there. But no. The guy, $350,000 of his own money to get that thing made and put there clandestinely. And now, I mean, everybody loved it. So it was kept there for 30 years.
It was moved for a brief period of time and the local people protested because it really did represent a sign of, yes, it was art, but also they recognize this is a symbol of strength of the American people. It was a sign of encouragement, essentially, and moving forward in your American dream. Well, what's happened just this last month, there's controversy because on March 7th, as everyone's celebrating these pro-women memories and moments, right, the State Street Global Advisor Group actually took a little girl statue and put it just feet away from and in front of the bull, kind of standing up to the fearless bull. It's another one of those girl power, women are the best moments, and it's supposed to be a symbol. The plaque reads, "Know the power of women in leadership." And essentially what it is it's a pro-gender diversity piece.
Yeah, it's this, it's a pretty cool statue. The little girl there has got her hands on her hips and she's facing out, not angry at the bull, but just, I'm strong, I can stand here, I'm going to take it, very confident.
Yes.
In and of itself, nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with confident young girls.
But what happens is that it's turned a great symbol of the culture of the United States in New York in an incredible piece and has suddenly turned the charging bull into a symbol of oppression. Women are being silenced and where there's a lack of gender equality, when in reality, the bull was about American people and their strength. And now this girl statue is suddenly turning into, it is just about women.
Yeah, it's changed the meaning. Of course, everyone's happy with the girl. You know, well, I'm not going to say anything about the girl, but the guy who originally put the bull there, the artist, he wants it removed because he's saying, hey, you've changed the meaning of my piece of art. You've made it the villain. And it was the hero of the story, a symbol of greatness. Now it's a symbol of what's all that's wrong with America.
Yeah.
How dare you? Now, several things about that. I mean, we're going to talk about some of the gender issues here later in the show. I was interested in how people treat art, that it's this malleable thing, that it's up to me to just change it and make it a meaning for myself. It's my responsibility to walk in there. And this really is a common perception of art,
modern art.
Of modern art is that it's subjective. It's up to the person on the receiving end to decide what the art means. Mm-hmm. Now, as someone who creates stuff, I've never bought that. I'm like, no. The artist gives it the meaning. It's up to the artist to tell you what this is all about. If there's some subjective thing, okay, that's fine. But don't tell me, whether it's a book, a movie, whatever, a piece of art, I can't paint or anything. But, right, it's not up to you to decide, ultimately. It's objective. It's not subjective.
Well, but everything's relative to people. And when you see that not only in thinking but in art, the symbolism of the way people approach art is a huge symbol of how people are thinking and acting in a culture.
Oh, yeah. It's a symbol of life. Right. Everything is subjective. And so this is a bit ironic to me on several levels. On one, I get that, no, you don't get to come and just decide that the bull is now a symbol of patriarchy.
Right.
What if I came to you and said, oh, I think the girl is a symbol of how weak women are or whatever. Like, this is, you know, to me, it seems like the bull's the real strength here and the bull's going to smash them, right? Oh,
that's true.
That's what it means to me. No, you would say, no, Don, you're wrong. Whoa, wait a minute. I thought this was all subjective. You know, I thought we could make it our own meaning. I thought it's up to me to decide. And so there's always a little bit of irony pushback.
Yes.
Because do I get to decide what the girl means? Well, no, right? The artist put it there and now he's changed. So a lot of different elements to this story that intrigue me.
And I think one of the last elements that kind of just stood out to me as we were talking too is that this was installed by a Sicilian immigrant, someone who moved to the United States and moved here for the American dream, to pursue, you know, the land of opportunity. And that's opportunity to become and move. It doesn't mean that we should entitle you and just pave the way for one type of person or one sex. And so even from that perspective, it's just total disrespect to those people who migrate here legally to the United States and pursue truly in the American dream and the flourishing of the human person.
Yeah, there is a different approach to what America means, what America is all about, whether America is sort of the hero in the story. Nowadays, often it is treated as the patriarchal oppressor, and we look at the bull as charging as bad, whereas in the past it would have been the symbol of strength.
Yeah. So, I just can't understand that. But there's lots more to talk about. You mentioned transgender issues right now. We talked earlier in the week, and I'm begging you, if you didn't hear it, to go back and listen to the podcast episode of the coverage of this new show, 13 Reasons Why. Well, as we talked about that, we were kind of talking about some of the cool and trendy things and how just horrible the show is in turning suicide into entertainment, but how also we didn't mention this, but that teens tend to like to emulate what they see as being popular. Now, this is what we're seeing now as well with the transgender movement. It's suddenly cool. It gets attention.
Interesting story in LifeSite News out of Brisbane, Australia. Children think it's cool to be transgender, and they're trying the self-identity out in droves, claims an Australian psychiatrist. Stephen Stathis runs a gender clinic in Brisbane, and there they're supposed to be diagnosing gender dysphoria, which is a legitimate thing, right? Like that, we get that. But what he's finding is there's a lot of people who don't have that. They're just trying out being transgender. They're making a choice. They're like, well, maybe I will, maybe I won't. I'll try it for a week or a month or a year. And then they go in and out of it. And this, to me, speaks to a lot of issues, including the one, hey, I thought all of these sexual identity things were set. I mean, I thought they were born this way and we're just discovering the reality of the situation.
Yes.
Does not seem that way if you are doing it because it's trendy. In fact, I just saw, as a side note, I saw Harvard released this week some guidelines for their students, and they said that gender may change in people day to day. So you need to be aware. This was, I think it was a note to like leaders in the school or maybe to other students. Be aware that gender may change in some people day to day. So you need to be.
Do you hear that, Don? Do you hear that? My eyes are rolling so far back in my head. You could probably hear it over there. This is ridiculous. So gender can transition at any moment because it's fluid. So I may be a male today, a female tomorrow. And what next? Am I going to be a fifth grader male this afternoon and I can go back to fifth grade? I mean, what are we going to say next? This is ridiculous. We're saying that reality isn't even real.
Yeah, there is no objective reality. It's up to you to decide everything about each day.
Well, and this is really interesting, Don, because I was actually this morning listening to a huge plug here for Patrick Coffin's new podcast, The Patrick Coffin Show. He's had some incredible expert interviews. But on the one that I was listening to this morning, it's talking about addiction and the addiction of the glow. A lot of people in the next generation are actually being called the glow kids because they're addicted to screens. Mm. And there's no conversation really being had about it on the level that they're should be, whether it's the cell phone, social media, Pinterest, video games, whatever it might be. But I bring it up because one of the things that really stood out is how now what's happening is this doctor who's working in addiction therapy, essentially, is saying that we're becoming so addicted. If you add on to that, what's happening is that people are living essentially in a perpetual virtual reality, and they're having a tough time distinguishing between what is real and what's not. And how when you're a little kid, you go through this like reality checker. You're 5 years old. Well, is this real? Am I real? What am I? But in a world where we are just trying to escape from reality, and our reality is just a text message conversation, the Pinterest world, or the video game reality we create, all of a sudden, if we create this mindset and allow it to continue, nothing's real to us.
It's like we are all our own avatar, right? It's those video games where you create your own character and you travel around. You can make them look however you want and feel.
Yes.
And, well, we're all that. We're all like just an avatar that we create perpetually.
We can change at any whim.
I know that my kids, even their little Wii games where you can make your own character, you know, and they love to go back and just change it up, you know, switch things around, switch the hair, switch all that. Yeah, but do we want to do that on a real level, like a real life level? That seems to be what we're doing. And apparently your gender can change day to day. And that's why this guy in Australia is finding that, listen, these kids are just coming in. They have peer pressure, whatever. They want to be cool. So, hey, I think I'm going to try out this whole transgender thing. Is that what it is? Is that what we're fighting for?
Well, and we're even seeing in Australia, they have this gender service that's being implemented by the government. And the goal of most of it is that working with the gender confused children, and it's just allowing and opening the door for more young people to receive really hormone replacement therapy that's creating serious problem for people right now.
Well, this is interesting. Hold on. I thought it was just a choice. I thought we could transition back and forth day to day. I thought the biology actually doesn't have anything to do with it.
Yes.
Why would we want to do the whole hormone thing? That's the question.
Timmery and Don will be right back. Tweet them at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. And at Don Johnson Media. This is Trending with Don and Timmery on Immaculate Heart Radio. To learn more about Don Johnson or Timmery Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit donjohnsonministries.org or timmery.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.
Don, before we move on from this piece, you know, we're talking about how today transgender is the new cool thing for teens. teens are looking for attention. They're looking for unconditional love. Just like that sweet girl, Hannah, who committed suicide in 13 Reasons Why. These, I think, are signs of the time that children need this attention, this love. And if they're looking to transition or seem different, it's because there's something going on. And a lot of the time, one of the things that Dr. Stathis is talking about, a doctor who works with gender issues with young people, is that a lot of the time this is actually has really strong correlations to mental illness, and how a lot of the time when they have cases where a child is experiencing gender dysphoria, that they take them through mental illness screenings, essentially. But the big thing that he recommends to understand is that it's usually temporary, and we need to allow these phases to play through and work with people. And we can say it time and time again. If a 40-year-old got into a car accident and suddenly thought that they were a 5-year-old chimpanzee, we would work with them to understand that they are a 40-year-old male who is married to Susan, who has 3 children, and they have a 4th baby on the way. We would really work with them to understand and see reality.
Absolutely. So there are all these cases of, I think, severe mental illness that we need to deal with. But then I think there's lighter cases where kids are just sort of exploring. They're just doing stuff because everybody else is doing it, or they just want to try it out. I mean, get purple hair or whatever it is, right? And you talked about phases. I mean, phases are a real issue growing up. It's and nothing wrong with that.
So are you telling me, because you remember the whole feather in your hair trend a few years back?
No.
You know, okay, maybe your girls might have been a little young to be a part of it. So there was this thing where you'd have this feather put into your hair, so you'd have a pretty pink feather. I was always kind of sad I never had it done. I've been thinking about this feather a lot lately. But as we're looking at this, if I were to have a feather put in, would that mean that I'm transitioning into a chicken?
Right.
Would it?
I mean, we could take this very seriously, can't we? Way too seriously. New York Times piece just this last week. The headline is, "My daughter is not transgender, she's a tomboy." And this poor lady, Lisa Davis, tells about how she's so sick and tired of everybody asking if they need to call her daughter a boy. Oh, is she a boy? Is she transitioning? She's like, no, my daughter is just a tomboy. She just likes to do some masculine things. So what? Leave her alone. Let her be herself.
Well, and they answered their own question. Is she a boy?
Well,
she is a she.
It's so ridiculous. Like, it gets so frustrating for the parents and so oppressive to the kids. That's the thing. Maybe she grows out of that, likely. And if not, so what, right? I mean, why do we want to pin people into this box that we're telling them to? And this is what I think many of these kids who are, you know, quote, trying out transgenderism. I mean, how much of that is on us as a society telling them, hey, this is the latest thing to be cool, and we're forcing them to try things, in a sense.
Right.
Like the latest fad, you know? And I just think, man, we got to be stronger than that. It's anti-person.
Yes.
To be so forceful.
And it puts pressure on these little kids. And I just have to say, I'm sorry. If I were her, I would say, I'm sorry. Unless my child suddenly has male anatomy and needs to use a urinal for natural reasons, not because they received reconstructive surgery, please go talk to someone else.
So here's another related piece that I wanted to discuss with you. Why are so many lesbians getting pregnant? Is the question asked at the public discourse this week by Glenn Stanton. Now, again, isn't the backdrop to all of this, listen, gender is something that I thought we were born with it. Oh, no. Well, we're born with it, but not in a physical sense. In a mental sense, we have to figure out who we are. Oh, but what are all these kids doing going back and forth? What's with that? Well, this is another piece of data that I want to throw in the pot there. So I thought to be a lesbian meant that it was a woman attracted to a woman. Now, women can't impregnate women unless I'm really anti-science and haven't seen the latest on that.
It doesn't work that way, Don.
I don't think it does. So how is it, here's the thing, how is it that lesbians actually have a higher, get that, higher pregnancy rate than non-lesbian women?
This is actually something I can actually really speak to, Don, because working in the crisis pregnancy centers, we actually began to see this become more of a trend over the last couple of years, where we'd suddenly have this kid who came in, who's pregnant in high school or just out of high school. They experience what they're calling a same-sex attraction or gender confusion dysphoria, and they're identifying maybe as a transgender male, but they're really a female, pregnant, or maybe they're saying they're a lesbian. And it would always be interesting because you almost, I mean, I think the first response is you giggle because you're confused. You're concerned. But what's really going on in a lot of these cases, Don, is that there is actually some form of severe sexual and emotional abuse for these girls. And so they're struggling with their sexual identity. They're looking for attention. They're looking to work out the harm that was done for them. Maybe they're rejecting men in their life, or maybe they've been taken advantage of and they're just used to it. So you're seeing this huge blurring of any really adequate understanding of sexuality, that they're facing teen pregnancy and at the same time a same-sex relationship.
Yeah, it's 2 to 7 times higher. Get that. So 2 to 7 times higher if you call yourself a lesbian, 2 to 7 times higher chance or rates of getting pregnant. Mm-hmm. And I think you've hit on it. There's a lot of very deep issues that have led these kids to be hypersexualized. Obviously, the bottom line is they're having a lot more sex than your average population. That's the bottom line. And that, I would suggest, like you said, that shows a lot of pain, a lot of something missing in their history that they're trying to fill with sex.
Well, and if you look at it, Don, you made the point there's something they're trying to fill. There's something in their history. We keep talking about how the vast majority and the statistics are consistent with this, of people who are experiencing transgender struggles in their own life usually are experiencing mental illness as well. Well, it's natural. If you had a catastrophic, shocking experience as a child, even if it was just ongoing manipulation or abuse, sexual abuse, or maybe the absence of someone in your life, like an important parent, a mother or a father, mental illness can develop from a series of choices and justifications that the child has to go through. And these children need psychological help, care, and counseling.
And women seem to be especially, I don't know if susceptible is the right word, but when it comes to issues of same-sex attraction, the stats are that same-sex attracted men generally stay with that much longer. They're more consistent. Whereas women, it's much more fluid. They're much more likely to have sex with both male and female and to change at any time. So, for instance, in this story in the public discourse, they point out that female sexual orientation is very situation dependent. It's very flexible. This is why a woman like Anne Heche can suddenly find herself falling madly in love with Ellen DeGeneres after an exclusively heterosexual past. And she was, I think, in her 30s or 40s at that point. And why longtime lesbians can experience their very first other sex attraction in their late to middle ages, like 40s, 50s.
Yes.
It's very malleable. So there is something about the female experience, it seems, that is somewhat different than the male.
They're not set in that same-sex attraction. This is actually the case for most people. And a lot of men and women who experience same-sex attraction will say, don't call me a gay person. Gay is a lifestyle. I hate it. And I know we all have to be careful because it's become a norm, but we never want to say that gay man or that lesbian woman. I'll never forget one day being corrected when I was writing a piece on a child with Down syndrome. And I said, a Down syndrome baby, etc. And I had a mom who is actually a good friend of mine. She reached out. She said, hey, she said, I don't mean to kind of be that person who's complaining, she said, but, you know, my little child, they have Down syndrome, and it would mean the world to me and a lot of other people that instead of calling that Down syndrome baby, you said a baby with Down syndrome. And it's something that we've worked in Catholic communication as well, and more people are coming along in terms of how they articulate, of understanding the importance of this is a person, this is Sarah who is experiencing same-sex attraction, or Nicole, who has Down syndrome. That Down syndrome doesn't define who you are. That sin, whatever it is, doesn't define them. And this is something that I think is so important to the conversation, because people end up not being set in that sometimes temporary phase of dysphoria attraction.
We've just seen all the stats, right? The teenagers going back and forth throughout their whole lives. Yes. And indeed, it does them a disservice, doesn't it, to set their identity as that sexual. That's what the society does. The society wants to say, well, you are a gay person or whatever. No, first of all, your identity is not wrapped up in any of those desires.
Yes.
Maybe you experience them. Yep. Fair enough. We can discuss that and relate with you on that level. But you are a person made in the image of God. We need to love you. So that's an excellent point.
And I think that it would be good to also throw out some resources, especially for people who are experiencing struggle after having seen 13 Reasons Why, not sure how to talk to your kids, or maybe your kids have identified someone who have said, oh, well, I've considered committing suicide or I'm struggling. CatholicTherapist.com, a nationwide network where you can type in your information for the area you live in, and you will be able to find solid, well-educated therapists who aren't coming just throwing Jesus on you, but have a truly strong method of psychology that helps in the process of healing. And they're going to have a pro-family, pro-marriage. They're going to understand the impact of abortion and all of these gender dysphoria struggles that people have today.
Yeah, hugely important. CatholicTherapists.com. And it's not just because of the morals that they bring to it, but the entire worldview that they're speaking from, a more holistic, accurate worldview. So excellent resource. Please do check that out. And we will be right back.
From the studios of Immaculate Heart Radio, you're listening to Trending.
Trending.
With Dawn and Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
It's become a bit of cliche in Catholic circles that we live in a culture of death. Unfortunately, it's not a cliche. We really do live in a culture of death. I was reading a book this week called The Architects of the Culture of Death, talking about all of the big thinkers through the years. Not all of them, but many of them that have led us to this point. And every day, as I read the book and look around at culture, I think, yep, they're exactly right. Here's another exhibit starting last Sunday and airing for 6 episodes on Lifetime. Wasn't Lifetime like the pro-woman network? Isn't that the one that was supposed to have all these empowering woman stories? Here's the latest title. Mary Kills People is the title of the series. And it's apparently a very well-written, according to USA Today, an exciting thriller-type story where an emergency room doctor saves people during the day, but at night moonlights as a Dr. Kevorkian-style mercy killer. Now, the fact that they would put Dr. Kevorkian in there in sort of a positive light. I mean, this man was evil, an evil killer who traveled around. I don't know if you remember Dr. Kevorkian, but traveled around with his death machine.
And is this a movie or a real person?
No, real life, real life.
Give me the synopsis, because I don't know.
Basically, a man who would travel around with a death machine and kill people who wanted to be killed.
Intentionally. And he would just, as their prescription, this is what he'd do?
Yeah.
Wow.
Right? They wanted to end their life. He would do it for them with his death machines. So she is this mercy killer. I hate that. It's all propaganda, ladies and gentlemen.
It's
all propaganda. Physicians. No, it's killing people, okay?
At least
the title's accurate. Mary Kills People. It's nice that they put that in there, at least.
I'll be interested to check out an episode and see how they approach it, because every TV show right now is covering physician-assisted suicide.
Yeah, well, and this is even what they say. Assisted death is a topic that's timely, but here on this show, apparently it's dealt with in such a poignant and complicated way, says Lifetime programming chief Liz Gately. If you look at the number of shows out there and the quality, you have to place your bets very carefully. I'm like, oh, among all the scripts we get for killing people, this is the one we really liked, apparently. This stuff drives me crazy.
And the fact that they're saying, yes, it is a timely topic, but death is not complicated. You either research and work with a detective to figure out why a person died. Did they die from natural causes? Were they murdered? Or did they kill themselves? Or were they in an accident? Those are 4 things. Again, you have one of those options. And here we're talking about a TV show that this woman fights to save these people's lives. And they're showing almost the dramatic difference. In the daytime, she saves. And the nighttime, it's an act of mercy in these complicated situations to give a life-ending dosage of medication to intentionally kill them.
Indeed. Not only does she save lives during the day, this is the paragraph from the producers. There was something so interesting about Mary secretly ending someone's life. And then in the next scene, she's going to her daughter's dance recital, says creator Tara Armstrong. So that's even beyond, right? Let's beyond, okay, there's sort of a juxtaposition between saving and ending. No, this is normalizing. Not only is she a doctor, but she's a mother who goes to her daughter's dance recital.
She's so loving and caring.
She's loving and caring, and then she ends. That's the thing, right? That's the, you're cheering for her, but she kills people. And the title, I think, is actually pretty slick propaganda, too, because it defuses the truth.
Yeah, it's she like, doesn't really kill people.
Well, even if we say she does, I mean, what does that mean?
She's helping them. She's alleviating their suffering. You guys, you need to stop being silent as these TV shows just come in and say, this is okay. This is mercy. It's not mercy, because what matters is our eternal salvation. What matters is doing things right. What matters is loving, and suffering provides a tremendous amount of development and growth for the individual and how they love.
Yeah. And it's so important. I know we talk a lot about television and movies here on Trending. There's a reason for that. That's the most powerful force in the culture right now. It's all propaganda. Okay. That's the thing.
Yes.
It's all propaganda. And it's very effective propaganda, at least when it's done well. When it's a well-told story, we talked about this on the last show, a well-told story with good characters doing evil things. So we talked about 13 Reasons earlier this week. Same thing, right? Well written. People are loving the story. You're doing evil things, right? Suicide and bringing people to suicide. And now this, another well written story, likable character, ending someone's life. This is how all of these cultural things happen. I've said many times on the show, we don't have same-sex marriage today in the country, if not for shows like Will and Grace and Modern Family. Everything else, all the politics, whatever. Those shows were the prime mover of that. We have to have the lies. And that's the thing. It is lies. It's just not true. Timory, let's end the show on a positive note. It's still Easter.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. You know, you mentioned that we're living in a culture of death. But as Pope John Paul II so often talked about, the contrast between the culture of death and the culture of life. And we have to remember, we have this long season of Easter to be reminded that we are the resurrection people. We are the people of life. And I think we need to add the people of light. God brought light into the world in the midst of sin and darkness, and you were being called to walk through that. So let's talk about, from a scientific perspective and a little theology here, the Shroud of Turin.
The Shroud of Turin, something that I was unaware of, to be honest. I mean, I knew about
really?
It, but as a Protestant, never really was on my radar.
Welcome to being Catholic again.
Wow, you know, and there's a reason. I don't know. We're not going to get into all the reasons on that again.
Yes.
But Protestantism, just as it's not a physical-based religion. And in that sense, it doesn't take the incarnation for all that it is. Uh-huh. A lot of Protestantism, frankly, whether Jesus came and died or not, it's actually a little bit beside the point. The key thing is God forgives, and it's intellectual and it's legal. You don't need all the physical stuff. Not so with Catholicism.
No, not at all.
Very physical. And so, this week, a new study was released that brings new evidence that further authenticates two holy relics.
Yes.
One, the Shroud of Turin, and the other, which I'm even less aware of, the Sudarium of Oviedo.
Yes.
Which is the cloth around Jesus' head, apparently.
So these are the two cloths that we read about in sacred scripture in the Gospels that were found. You read about it in the Gospel of John, for example, when Mary Magdalene, St. Peter, John ran to the tomb. They come in and there are cloths sitting in the corner. Well, this was odd to begin with, Don, because as we know from the perspective of someone like thieves and tomb robbers, if they were coming to steal something, they wouldn't take the body. They would take the expensive linens, the burial cloth.
Sure, they just take everything, I would assume, right?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what's so odd. We read in the Gospel of John, chapter 20, verse 7, that they were sitting there in the center. This is so weird. They would have taken these. So it's one of those proofs that is often used. But when we look at it, we today have the Shroud of Turin and the cloth of Sudarium that are both in 20 different cases, over 20 cases, have crossovers that show that not only are they both used for the same person, but what happens is usually you only need 8 to 10 worldwide,
right.
And that's a high number to authenticate and substantiate these claims.
Right. That doesn't prove that it was Jesus, just those two things, but it does show pretty conclusively that it whatever person that was on it was the same person.
Yes.
And then I was interested, again, I'm somewhat new to all the science of the shroud, but the fact that they don't know what the substance is that's on top of the shroud. It's not in the cloth. The blood, there's blood that's gone into the cloth.
So there are two parts.
Two parts. There's blood that's in the cloth, AB, which is rare.
And AB also male, which is very rare on both pieces of linen.
And then there's this substance that they can't figure out. This is amazing. What? We can't figure out what a substance is today with all of our technology? It's amazing.
And if you've seen any images, and I've actually been to presentations on the Shroud of Turin, it blew my mind. But the image on the front and back, so you see the front side, it's like a negative of Jesus's face and full frontal body, and it's in the correct anatomical position of the body,
and it
too.
Has all the scars, like all the flogging over 100 lashes, it seems. Oh,
yeah, man. It's so fascinating. Some of the neat, I think, elements that come in. We mentioned the AB blood type that's on both for a male individual. You also, on the blood stains, there are actually only a handful of blood stains around the head area that are consistent both on the head cloth and on the Shroud of Turin, and they're consistent with sharp thorn-like pieces that dug deep into the skin. Same blood found on each of these cloths.
Which would not have been apparently the only recorded instance of someone wearing the crown of thorns during crucifixion is Jesus. So that's interesting.
Two things together, crown of thorns and crucifixion. Not only that, they also show that the pollens found on it, and you have to recognize, this is the most historic and well-tested piece of religious and artifact that has been tested and tested over and over again. And they show to this day that the pollens found on it were only pollens known in ancient Israel. And they're on both of the cloths.
Now, I heard growing up, I remember this, that they did some carbon-14 testing on this thing, and it was some sort of middle-aged forgery. That's all been debunked pretty conclusively now. It's another beautiful example of the historicity of our faith.
The proof.
And the fact that we have evidence. It's not one of those religions where you just have to put your brain in your back pocket and just believe based on nothing. No, we have evidence. You know, we just had the readings of Doubting Thomas, right?
Yes.
I think this is sort of a thing for Thomas's in us all. Like, here's another beautiful piece of evidence. All right. Thanks for being here, Timory.
Thank you.
Enjoy your speaking this week. Don't forget to go to reversetherevolution.com. We're in the final days of the fundraising for my Sexual Revolution doc. So go check that out. And we'll see you next time.
This has been Trending with Dawn and Timory on Immaculate Heart Radio.
Trending.
To learn more about Dawn Johnson or Timory Millington, or to book either of them to speak, visit DawnJohnsonMinistries.org or Timory.com. And be sure to share and rate the podcast of the show on iTunes.